I know a man who was a child during the Great Depression when things had to last for a long time. You took care not to wear out your Sunday clothes by using them on weekdays. You patched the overalls when the knees split. If you had older brothers, you got their hand-me-downs. If you had no older brother, you had cousins. And you got their clothes. A little jingle that Shakespeare did not write may stir a memory for some of you. There are Pete, Pete's the oldest, there are Pete, Jim, Jack, George, Joseph, and Ned. A half dozen boys to be clothed out and fed. I buy for them all plain groceries to eat, but clothing, I only buy clothing for Pete. You can imagine what things looked like by the time they got to poor Ned, who spent his childhood wondering if he would ever have anything new in his life. In the childhood of Jesus, depression was probably permanent. The parable about the patch and the wineskin, which you heard Natalie read, were probably learned at home. After so many years of wear, Mary would have said to herself, better not put that patch of unshrunk cloth on the old jacket, because when you wash it, the patch will shrink and tear the worn-out fabric. Better not hang on to the old wineskin bottle too long, because one day when you pour in the new wine and it ferments, there won't be enough stretch left and the bottle will split. The eternal human dilemma. Take good care of what you already have, but don't wait too long to change. The new and the old. What do we keep? What do we toss? Where is the line between being faithful and just being stubborn? Between being pioneers and being settlers? There was a day when some of the settlers, stubbornly in love with the old ways, came to Jesus and said, we're amazed. We all fast at regular times in our religious life, but you've skipped some of those times, and so have your disciples. How dare you make such a change? Maybe they had read one of their own sacred books called Ecclesiastes, with its ultra-conservative mood. That which has been is that which shall be, and that which has been done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. The man who wrote that was tired, disillusioned. Jesus didn't live long enough to be either one, and what he said to his critics is a model for church life. Fasting is fine when it's appropriate, but a mechanical ritual may not always be appropriate. So wait until it is, and don't be afraid to be honest about matching your ritual to the reality of your life. Those were daring ideas. New wine is forever being poured into the old wineskin of personal life or church life, where it ferments safely enough until the wineskin no longer has any flexibility left, at which point the wineskin splits, the wine runs out on the floor, and we're in trouble. You accommodate the old and the new as well as you can, but there always comes a moment when you can't do it anymore and you have to change. That's the moment when the conservative and the liberal run smack into each other. Tradition squares off against innovation. The past goes to war with the future. The interesting thing is that no matter how much they fight and call each other names, these two sides need each other. The conservative who resists change is as valuable as the liberal who proposes it. I preach the gospel of one who was killed for being too liberal, but no one believed more strongly than he did or than I do in the values of tradition. Like any other family, mine inherited certain cherished customs and then deliberately set about creating some more, and together they give us, no matter how we go our separate ways, a wonderful sense of continuity, even down to such trivial things as our own tribal call for recognition, which I would know instantly if I heard it in a crowd anywhere on earth, and our own family farewell, with the departing automobile honking in exactly the same way each time. The kids, by the way, like this sort of thing just as much as the grown-ups. Children have the same mental paradox the rest of us have. Life propels them forward, and they welcome it, but one hand likes to hold on to things the way they were. Thousands of children were moved from London out into the countryside during the Blitz of World War II on the theory that they simply had to be spared the trauma of bombs and burning buildings. But as it turned out, the kids left behind in familiar surroundings with people they knew seemed to end up in better psychological health than the ones who were moved, despite the bombs. So we need the old. We need tradition, but we can't be frozen in it. It's possible to get so resistant to change that we lean backwards into utter nonsense. I read about an Arab, hungry one night, who lighted a candle and broke open the first of a saucer of dates for dinner. It had a worm in it. So he tossed it. He tried another, and it had a worm. A third, and it had a worm. I know what I would have done, but he was a very conservative man. He blew out the candle and ate the fourth date in the darkness. Jesus didn't know that story, but he would have told it, I think, as a parable of people who will put up with anything before they'll make a change. Instead, he told the one about the goatskin bag he had seen hanging on the wall in his own house and in other people's houses. And he said to his followers, you have to be flexible. You have to be able to stretch. I'm around some people each week who work out in a gym to keep their muscles in tone. The woman who supervises them insists on lots of stretching. She saw me limping one morning from a muscle spasm, and she said sternly, she is a kind of major general type, how much stretching do you do? And when I answered, she said, not enough. And she told me to triple it. Sure enough, it worked. Just as it does for the heart and the mind. If we stop stretching, we freeze and die somewhere along about middle age, because the world around us is in ferment. It keeps pouring its new wine into our lives, and if they've gone stiff and inflexible, it spills, and we've lost it. Churches work the same way. People who come from creedal churches are always puzzled by ours because we do not have a creed. A creed being a formal, rigid list of things people must believe about quite a number of things before they can belong. We have a covenant, that is, an agreement that we will walk together in the name of Christ, that we will read and interpret for ourselves as honestly as we can, and that we will expect and tolerate differences of opinion, because every mind is different in its capacity and skill from every other. But this is not the majority view in churches. So last week, a bright young woman said to me, "What is your church built on? What are the basics?" I started to talk about reverence and respect for the teachings of Christ, a conviction that love and justice and genuine brotherhood are essential, a willingness to honor those who read what we read but understand it a little differently. And she broke in impatiently to say, "But name the things you believe in." I thought I had just done that, but I realized that it did not work for her. She was used to a church that says, "You must believe this about baptism, its manner and its meaning. You must believe this about communion, this about the birth of Jesus, this about the miracles. You must understand and accept these ideas about heaven and hell and the second coming. And if you accept these ideas, which make up our creed, then you can belong to this church." We don't do that. We think anyone who is alive, reading and interpreting her own experiences, is growing all the time, stretching all the time, and we ask ourselves, how will a rigid, inflexible creed contain all that new and fermenting wine without a personality split? The truth is that despite our own formula for growth, we find it hard enough ourselves to accept change. We settle quickly into routines, and the moment we do, we think they are sacred and untouchable. I learned long ago that we need to be careful about anything we introduce into a church, because as soon as we have it for a few months, it becomes a tradition which most people will be convinced has been around forever. I actually know of certain customs which I began myself in a church, and then when I proposed changing them a few years later in response to changing times, people said, "Oh, we can't give that up. We've always done it that way." I'd be tempted to say, yes, since January 7th, 1975, when I did it for the first time, but I would remember to be wiser than that, and I would say instead, "Always? How long exactly? And they'd say, oh, for years and years before you came, we can't remember how long it was. So we're always in that quandary Jesus described when he told his little stories about old patches on new garments and new wine poured into old bottles. A doxology. I speak now to a beloved friend who will understand. A doxology is any form of words that praises God. But change the particular words you've grown accustomed to, and suddenly you feel awkward, which is a sure proof that the distinction between the wineskin and the wine has gotten itself confused. Forgive us our trespasses. Forgive us our debts. Forgive us the wrongs we have done. No one would deny that the last sentence is the clearest, punching the truth straight into our hearts in the language we use every day. Forgive us the wrongs we have done. But almost any church that chose to be clear and compelling to use that translation from the New English Bible rather than the familiar would be in trouble. Every church strikes its own balance. My guess is that our usual practice could be described in that famous couplet by Alexander Pope. Be not the first by whom the new is tried, nor yet the last to lay the old aside. For people who prefer garish novelty, that isn't enough. And for people who distrust anything new, it still sounds radical. But it strikes me as a pretty sensible motto. If the new has no root in the old, it withers. If the old grows no new leaves, it dies. If I've seemed to come down a little harder on the need for change, it's because generally people need that encouragement more than they need to be reminded of how comfortable the old ways are. So let's tip the scale a bit toward growth and flexibility by hearing Tennyson's marvelous lines from The Idylls of the King. The old order changeth, yielding place to new, and God fulfills himself in many ways, lest one good custom should corrupt the world. We limit God when we imagine that only the old familiar ways will work, but he expresses himself in many ways. Otherwise, a single good custom would corrupt the world, because no custom, however good, can serve forever in a changing world. And if you try to hold on to it too long, it goes rotten in itself and rots the very souls of those who cannot turn it loose. What I understand from the three short parables we have mentioned this morning is that form exists to express the living spirit. The wineskin exists for the wine. In every new generation, we pour it from one perishable vessel into another, trying not to spill a drop. And that's a great and difficult challenge, but all too often, in a kind of tragic blindness, we invest the wineskin itself with sanctity. Don't do it, the parables say. The form grows old. The spirit seeks forever a new house. The Christian imperative of each new generation is to build that house and open the door.